Hello, and welcome to Southern Stories. I'm your host, Bobby Matthews. This is where I'll share some of my short fiction that focuses on life in the Deep South, and specifically in Alabama. Today I'm sharing a piece called Visitation at Nine, and one of the things I really like about it is that it's almost 100% true. Only the names have been changed in order to protect the innocent. And in some cases, to protect the guilty. Now, here is Visitation at Nine. She spotted me in the line, as I knew she would. I was 10 people back, whispering with Andrew Snodgrass. We were passing the time, each remembering what a son of a bitch the other had been, grinning a little, but being quiet about it, so as not to bother the others who had come to pay their respects to the family. From a few feet away, Kelly Gilpin didn't look like she'd changed all that much. Still blonde, still blue-eyed, still buxom in that overripe way that had never pleased her when we were in high school together. She was wearing a black pantsuit with matching heels, the dutiful daughter in mourning. Gold glinted at her throat and earlobes. Her complexion hadn't changed. Still peaches and cream. Heavy on the cream. She was standing alone, greeting the mourners one by one, occasionally casting a glance down the line at the next person. 50 yards away, in the sanctuary of this cavernous city block of a church, her father lay in his casket, but his family was stuck with the macabre duty of receiving visitors for an hour before they laid Conrad Gilpin to rest. Kelly saw me during one of those covert glances, and her eyes widened. We hadn't seen each other in 22 years. Back then, I'd been thinner. Had hair, too. But she recognized me. It didn't startle her, give her that. In the years since we'd last met, she had taught kindergarten to thousands of snotty brats, and she was likely practiced in the art of not letting her feelings show. It was Andrew who'd messaged me on Facebook 2 days prior, linking me to the obituary for Conrad Gilpin. He was 84 when he died, although he'd been an old man from the moment I'd met him. As a high school junior in his AP English class, I would have believed he was 84 when he was born. Mr. Gilpin didn't walk. He shuffled. His hair was white, and he was stoop-shouldered. He never raised his voice in class. He didn't have to. His quiet sarcasm could cut down an unruly teenager more viciously than a shout. I thought you'd want to know, Andrew wrote, and provided the obituary link. Of course I'd want to know. Kelly had once been my closest friend, back when I was a half-formed human being and didn't have many people who could put up with me. I was the unreliable narrator of my own life, all the while not realizing that someone like Holden Caulfield might be interesting to read about, but no one would actually want to spend time around the little asshole. As my friend, Kelly was long-suffering. She often made apologies for my behavior when I didn't know how to make them on my own. Andrew nudged me in the ribs with his elbow. I don't see her husband, he said. Do you? I looked around and shook my head. I don't, I whispered back, but I saw the guy one time, 20-odd years ago. How the hell would I know him now? Andrew shrugged and we moved up a space as Kelly finished with one well-wisher, and the endless conveyor belt of mourners moved forward. Earlier, I'd sat in the church parking lot, waiting, letting the ice-cold air conditioning prickle my skin while the late summer outside boiled away uselessly. It couldn't get to me in the car. 5 minutes until 9 a.m. and it was already 87 degrees and climbing. The funeral was at 10 a.m., but the obituary said visitation began at 9. I didn't really know what I was waiting for. If I shut the car off, I'd have to go in. I'd see people that I'd known once, a long time ago, and I'd be happy to see them, but sad, too, because they wouldn't know me anymore. They would know the boy I'd been, half-formed and full of certainties. They wouldn't know the man who had replaced that boy, who had substituted his doubts and insecurities for the cockiness and surety of a 17-year-old kid who still had all of his hair. I texted Andrew, made it down, sitting in the side parking lot now. The church was huge, with multiple parking lots, so that I had to specify where I was parked. "Do you want to go in with me?" he wrote back. Andrew was a son of a bitch in high school, but like me, he'd become something different as an adult, something kinder and fuller than the boy I used to know. "We'll see," I texted back, knowing full well that I'd wait on him. It would be easier to go inside the church, to be near Kelly, if someone was with me. I saw him drive in at the wheel of a late model Kia SUV. I got out of the silver Malibu I'd rented for the drive down, locked the doors, and ambled over. By the time we faced one another, there were only 10 feet of asphalt and a wellspring of long years between us. He still had all of his hair, the bastard. His salt and pepper beard gave his otherwise boyish face a look of stolid maturity. I stuck out my hand for him to shake. "The hell with that," he said. "I'm gonna hug your neck." So we hugged each other, a curious thing for grown men who only really know each other by our activities and chat over social media. But it was comforting, too. We walked together into the sanctuary. It was bigger than the last time I'd been there, a high-ceilinged room with dark-stained beams crossing the ceiling, with a pair of chandeliers, one above the altar down front, and one above the pews in the rear. Outside, it was sunny, and light flooded through the stained glass windows so that the chandeliers could stay dark. Conrad Gilpin's casket lay in front of the altar, one half of the lid propped open so that we could see the body as we approached. An open casket funeral, a grotesquerie that seemed to be going out of style in most places. Here in the deep south, 90 minutes due north of Panama City Beach, Florida, the open casket funeral was still in style. I didn't want to go near the coffin, didn't want to see Mr. Gilpin's body lying there. But Andrew spotted Jennifer Sanders, a girl we'd both known and sometimes lusted after, through church, and drifted down toward the coffin with her. I trailed along in their wake, like a piece of flotsam heading for the shore. Jennifer looked thinner and grayer than she had when we were young. She still used very little makeup, or had become so artful at its application that it looked as though she didn't. She and her husband, Thad, had married during college and now had 5 children. One was already in college himself, which seemed impossible. I shook my head as I listened to Andrew making small talk, marveling that someone my age could have a child who had already finished high school, or that someone with our shared Methodist background could have so many offspring. My God, we weren't Catholic. My own children were 7 and 4, ages that I thought appropriate for someone with my own lack of maturity. Close up, the body didn't look like the man I'd known. I'd been to enough funerals by then to know that it never does. When I was young, the old folks would always look down at the body in the box and say things like, "He looks just like he get up and talk, don't he?" But it wasn't true then, and it isn't true now either. A dead body looks like a dead body, and whatever makeup and skills the morticians use can never erase the fact that the spark of life is simply gone from the husk that we leave behind. The three of us paused at the casket, and for a long moment we said nothing, because there was nothing to say. Conrad Gilpin had been a good man, had taught each of us the basic rules of English grammar and encouraged us to read and write, and think, never forget that part, critically. If we had passed out of his classroom so many years ago, the shadow of the good man he had been still lingered in our remembrances of him. Mr. Gilpin's influence in my own life was reason enough to make the 3-hour trip down from Birmingham, following the unwinding traffic down I-65 South, nearly missing the complicated interchange with I-85 North and following that unspooling ribbon of asphalt along the backbone of Montgomery, down to Old Taylor Road, to US 231, and then finally turning onto Alabama Highway 167 into my hometown. We retreated from the body in the box, and then Jennifer had to go. She was helping Kelly's family, of course. In times of need, Jennifer would pitch in for just about anyone. It was a defining part of her character. Andrew and I found a place to sit on one of the cushioned pews in the middle of the sanctuary, not too far back and certainly not too close to the front where the family would be seated. "We did some terrible things in this building," Andrew said, his voice low, so as not to disturb the folks sitting around us. It made me smile. "I won't talk about it if you don't," I said, and that made him snicker quietly. An usher came forward with the solicitous manner of funeral directors everywhere, asking if we were members of the family. "Yes," I could have said, "a lifetime ago." Instead, Andrew and I shook our heads. We weren't family. After all this time without contact, without even any kind of word from Kelly, we weren't really friends either. The best I could have told the man was that we were witnesses. We'd witnessed Kelly growing up, witnessed her getting married, and now we were here to witness her father's passing. I could have said all of that, but by the time the words occurred to me, Andrew had already told the man that we were friends of Kelly's from high school and college. The usher told us where the family was receiving visitors, saying that he was sure they'd be happy to see us. He was much more positive about it than I was. But after a moment, Andrew and I rose and walked out of the sanctuary, down a long hall that had not existed when we'd gone to church here, and found ourselves at the back of a line of well-wishers, mourners, and witnesses like ourselves. Now it was Andrew's turn in line. I had stepped back deliberately, letting him go before me, putting his body between Kelly and me. Stalling, in other words. What do you say to someone you'd once known so well, someone who had known your hopes and dreams, just as you had known hers? Someone who, once she got married, cut you and nearly all of her friends out of her life as neatly as clipping a coupon from a sales paper. A few warm comments passed between Andrew and Kelly, and then he moved down the line to share warm words of condolences with others in the family. Kelly turned her cornflower-colored eyes to me and smiled. "Paul," she said, and reached forward and hugged me with no hesitation at all. "It's so good of you to come." Up close, it was easier to read the passage of time upon her face. Little crow's feet peeked shyly out at the corners of her eyes, and small lines drew down at the corners of her mouth. Her eyes were pink and puffy where she had been holding back tears. We looked at each other without saying all of the things that needed to be said. I wished now that I'd put on a suit, but I'd worn clothes for comfort on the road, tan khaki slacks and a blue button-down shirt that was a little too frayed around the collar. But it was my favorite dress shirt, and I couldn't bring myself to part with it. "I'm sorry for your loss," I said. "Your dad was such a good man." What else was there to say? What else could I say here, while trapped in this interminable line of mourners, like one of a thousand souls trapped in one of Dante's circles of hell? We both paused, our silence spinning out a beat too long as we locked eyes. I realized that we didn't know each other anymore. I'd been out of her life far longer than I'd ever been in it, and whatever had passed in those intervening years had made us strangers to one another. In one world, the one in which we both lived and breathed, the awkward moment lasted only a couple of seconds. Anyone witnessing it wouldn't have given it a second thought. But somewhere else, in some universe where time has no meaning, where an hour or a day or a second or a year is all the same thing. I could sense that she knew everything that I wanted to say, and that I could understand everything that she wanted to tell me. In that place without time, we would go on speaking without words for eternity. "Well," Kelly said at last, "it's good to see you." "Yes," I said, "it's good to see you too. I'm sorry it wasn't under happier circumstances. Take care of yourself." And with that, we broke eye contact, and I moved on down the line. I caught up to Andrew at the far end of the room. He was standing with a bearded guy and a pair of tall young men who were fighting the good fight against acne, and losing. They were all making small talk, their faces pleasantly distant. Like me, Andrew had completed his duty and come to support the person that we'd used to know. I stuck out my hand to the man with the beard. "I'm Paul," I said. "Pleased to meet you," he said. "I'm Will." "Oh." I hadn't meant to say anything, but he'd startled the word out of me. "Will, of course. Kelly's husband. He'd put on pounds around the middle, hadn't we all, and lost some hair on top. He wore a bushy black beard that made him look more fierce than I remembered. And then, before I could rein in my tongue, "We met before one time, actually, at Kelly's wedding." I paused. Andrew paused. So did Will and the two tall young men beside him. And into the silence I blurted, "Of course, I guess it was your wedding, too." "The only reason I'm not a blooming idiot is because I'm not in season." I looked around for Andrew to save me, but his glib smoothness was no help at all. It seemed to have deserted him in the moment. There was no handhold anywhere, no crack in the rock of this mountain of mortification where I could jam my hand into the crease all the way up to the wrist like a python of bone and stop this hurtling plunge. I was falling to my emotional death, and these four were just witnesses to my tumble off the cliff. This was worse than the time I'd confused the anatomical term philtrum, that divider space under the human nose, for another anatomical term, frenulum, the underside of the head of the penis. And that was in church. I drew in a breath. If I could survive that embarrassment, I could survive this one. "Yeah," Will said dryly. "It was my wedding, too." He introduced me to the tall young men beside him. They were Kelly's sons, and his, too, naturally. They had his height and her complexion, so that they looked slightly wind-chapped, even though we were in the apotheosis of summer. I shook their hands and smiled my empty smile at them. I learned there was a third boy, but he had enlisted in the Marines and was unable to attend the funeral. He was just as unreal to me as the two boys who were present. Kelly, the girl I had known anyway, had never had children. Hell, she'd never even had sex. We were alike in that way, both virginal and both dissatisfied about it. It never occurred to either of us that we could alleviate that particular condition for one another. Now, we were east of Eden, where we knew great and terrible things that we could not know when we were children. We just didn't know each other. The last time I'd seen Kelly was in 1996. She was working in Clarksville, Tennessee, a little suburb just south of the sprawling Fort Campbell, Kentucky military complex. A year earlier, she'd moved from Jacksonville, Florida, where she'd been the manager of a Kirkland's department store. The year in Tennessee changed her. We'd talked almost daily from the time we were in ninth grade until a year after she finished college at a private school in northern Kentucky. I was dropping in and out of college as if it had a revolving door, sometimes staying with my parents, sometimes sleeping on the floor at a friend's house, and sometimes crashing in the student union. Kelly was lonely in Jacksonville. I could hear it in her voice. I knew her so well back then. I could hear the thick, clotted, harsh sounds in her throat when tears would fill those bright eyes and roll eventually down her apple cheeks. She asked me to come visit a couple of times. I always shined her on. We had the phone, and the phone was enough for me. But when she moved to Clarksville to finally take a teaching job, things changed. The phone calls dried up. She was working long hours in her classroom, getting things just right. At night, I would call her and the phone would ring, and ring, and ring. I thought about driving up. I should have driven up. But North Tennessee is a long way from South Alabama. The phone was easier. The phone was enough, right? A few weeks later, when I finally got on the phone with her, she told me that she'd met a guy. He was in the construction business. No college, just a blue-collar, hard-working man. A guy who put roofs on top of houses and had plans to open his own business one day. And I, like the schmuck I was happy for her. What will you do if you get married? I asked her one time, my voice light and teasing. Will we still be friends? He'll have to understand, she said. You're my best friend. We're kind of, you know, a package deal. Her words made me smile, reassured me as I spoke into the receiver of the old landline phone at my parents' house. But within 2 months, Will started answering the phone at Kelly's apartment. When I was able to talk to her, things felt strained. We couldn't say things we might have wanted to say. A third person in any kind of relationship changes the dynamic. When she called to tell me about the new diamond ring on her finger, I knew that it was time for me to step aside. I didn't call her after that. I didn't get an invitation to the wedding. In those days, the only mail I got was overdue notices from the credit card companies and the student loan people, and all they wanted to know was when I'd begin to repay the thousands of dollars in debt I'd racked up. But I looked for an invitation every day as the year went on. None ever came. But the engagement announcement was in the paper. Of course it was. Mr. and Mrs. Conrad Gilpin announced the engagement of their daughter, Kelly, to Will whatever his name was. I stared at their picture for a long time before I ever read the announcement. It gave the date and the place and time for the wedding. It was the same Methodist church where her father would lie in state so many years later. The very same sanctuary. And it was the site where Kelly would take her vows. Would I go? Of course I would. Invitation or no, Kelly had meant too much to me to miss it. I don't know, Jacob Reeser told me before the ceremony. I don't think it's a good idea. I'd known Jacob just as long as I'd known Kelly. Jacob's father had money, and so he'd been able to go to the Tony Private College along with her. While she'd gotten a degree in early childhood education, Jacob had majored in Bible. I was majoring, off and on, in getting laid. Occasionally with a helping of journalism on the side. 6 years out of high school, and I was already the hedonist among our group of friends, despite the fact that I still rarely drank and never did drugs. You're probably right, I said. We sat on the tailgate of Jacob's Toyota Tacoma in the parking lot of the town's little newspaper about 3 blocks from the church. Jacob was wearing a summer weight suit, which is about the only formal outfit a man should wear in the Alabama heat. I had on navy blue slacks and a rust-colored tweed jacket. Sweat was already pooled at my armpits and the small of my back. My hair, already falling out at the crown, hung wet and limp over my forehead. I heard the guy's a real jerk, Jacob said. Jennifer was telling me that Kelly wanted to lose weight for the wedding, but the guy wouldn't even let her go to a co-ed gym. He got her a membership at an all-women's gym. Huh, I said. And I was driving through there on my way back to Wilmore, gonna visit some friends. I asked her if I could sleep on her couch if I got tired on the road, and that was a no-go, let me tell you. A complete non-starter.
Will wouldn't like it.
Well, I wasn't planning on forcing myself on her. I just wanted to use the couch for a night. In the sanctuary, Jacob and I found seats together. The air inside was ice cold, even though the place was packed. The sweat on my forehead dried while the organist played. Will and a few groomsmen slipped into the sanctuary from a side door and stood at the right side of the altar while the pastor took center stage. Jennifer Sanders was the first bridesmaid to enter, her slim figure clad in a pale peach dress, hair pulled back in an intricate chignon. Jennifer was a striking young woman who had slimmed down from an already small frame while at college, and now she was radiant. When she turned to come down the center aisle of the church, everyone gasped at how visibly pregnant she was. Jacob's ex-girlfriend, Cindy, was next. Raven-haired and doe-eyed, she was a perfect counterpoint to Kelly's Irish prettiness. Cindy was half Panamanian and half German, and I felt a sense of pride to see her up there at the altar. I was the one who had introduced Cindy to Kelly and Jennifer, not to mention Jacob, and even though I keenly felt the sense of loss of my dearest friend, I was still happy to be near people that I loved and who had once loved me back. A couple of more bridesmaids came out, but they were insignificant. I didn't know them and didn't care to. Then the music halted for the space of a moment, and we all rose to our feet as the first strains of the bridal march played. Kelly was beautiful. Her blonde hair had been further highlighted and piled atop her head in a convoluted tower held together with a combination of bobby pins and aquanet. Baby's breath blossoms shone in her hair like a tiara. She wore a lace veil that did nothing to hide her beauty, but instead magnified it. Her milky white shoulders were bare and toned. Whatever gym she had gone to had worked its magic. The excess pounds she'd carried in high school and college, the ones that had so often made her self-conscious, were gone. Her figure was a perfect hourglass, sheathed in a white gown. The train of her dress spread out behind her, and two small children held the end of it at either corner. Mr. Gilpin was beside her, and the force of his happiness and pride was warm and radiant. Kelly had to step carefully in her dress, so her slow pace matched the shuffle of her father's walk, and they made it down the aisle in step. There was a lump in my throat as she approached the altar, and I didn't understand why. When the music ended, I sat down and was glad that Jacob sat beside me. The preacher began with the dearly beloveds, and I tuned out until I heard the phrase, "If anyone here objects to this couple being joined in holy matrimony, speak now, or forever hold your peace." Kelly picked that moment to make eye contact with me. There was a pleading in her eyes that I couldn't read. Did she want me to stand up and voice an objection? Had she been waiting for me to say or do something all this time? For all these years that we had known and cared for one another? Had I missed my chance? Had I missed any and all signals? Or was it askance of a different sort? She had found her man and made her choice, so maybe the pleading was simply that I stay put and not make a damned fool out of myself, nor a farce out of her wedding. Beside me, Jacob gripped my arm so tightly that his knuckles were white. I tried to shrug away, but he kept his grip. We looked at each other, and I shook my head at him. I wasn't going to do anything. He dropped his hand in the still quiet silence of the moment for an objection, spun on like the elastic and perfectly sad moment after a child's heart drops on Christmas morning when all the presents have been opened and the paper lies cast aside. Then that moment passed, and the preacher spoke again, and I watched my best friend say, "I do." Later on at the reception, Will made a big production of lifting Kelly's skirt and sliding a white garter down her thigh, standing up afterward and twirling it around his index finger while the guests laughed as if this were the height of merriment. Tradition called for the uncoupled young men to try to catch the garter, so we all gathered in the foyer of the church's fellowship hall. Jacob and I, both at that age in our middle 20s, where our families and friends would like to see us married off and settled down, found ourselves pushed toward the front of a rowdy, laughing group of overgrown boys. On the stairs in front of us, Will held Kelly's garter taut in his left, on his left index finger, and pulled it back hard with his right hand. He snapped the garter right at me, and I plucked it from the air with one hand. It was decorated with white and pink roses. Around us, the party whooped with delight. Will and I looked at one another across the foyer without smiling. He nodded curtly at me, and I nodded back. To this day, I still don't understand why he shot Kelly's garter directly to me. Was it so that I, the loser friend who was no longer part of Kelly's life, would have a memento of my friend on a day that meant so much to her? Was it just another way to remind me that he had won and I had lost, that my time in Kelly's life as her friend was now over? I'll never ask him, so I guess I'll never know for sure. I didn't cry at the wedding, and I didn't cry at the reception either. I saved my tears for when I got into my truck. I was driving a little Ford Ranger that year, and its body was as dented and scarred and ugly as I felt when I left the church. But my eyes were brimming by the time I got the truck in gear, and I was full on bawling by the time I pulled onto the street. I parked in an empty lot a couple of blocks away where no one could hear me, and I screamed my loss in great, huge, gulping sobs. I sounded like an animal writhing in pain. And in some ways, I guess I was. Back in the present, Andrew and I made it back to the sanctuary. He found some of our old high school friends to chat with, but I couldn't sit still. I kept thinking about the stranger in Kelly's eyes that had looked back at me. Kept thinking how the years had erased all of the days and nights we'd known together. Kept thinking that the secrets we once shared were no longer our secrets, but artifacts lost to time. I looked down the center aisle of the church where Mr. Gilpin lay in his coffin. I had done what I came to do. I had paid my respects to a good and decent man. A man I had liked and respected a great deal during the time I'd known him, and I'd paid my respects to his family. My duty was discharged. I made apologetic noises to Andrew and the people around him, who were planning to go to lunch with one another once the funeral was done. Then I turned my back and walked out. On the way to my car, I could feel the lump in my throat rise like the tide. I pulled the car over a couple of blocks from the church and shifted it into park. The frigid wind blowing from the AC vents prickled the unsprung tears that stood in my eyes. But not one tear spilled, and no cries of sorrow escaped my lips. Not this time. I was older, and the feelings that had once burned so hot in my heart and soul were muted now, like watercolors faded in the sun. I had mourned my friendship with Kelly a long time ago, and I mourned it still. But the sting was far away and dulled by the passage of time. I put the car in gear and pulled out of the parking lot and drove away. That was Visitation at 9, and it is most definitely based on a true story. Thank you for listening, especially if you got past some of the parts where I stumbled. I'm trying to do this in one take, and hopefully I'll get better at it. If you like this story, please rate this podcast 5 stars wherever you find it. And if you want to talk about the content, or if you want to just drop me a line, you can reach me at matthews.freelance@gmail.com. That's Matthews with one T. matthews.freelance@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at BamaWriter, or follow me on Facebook, Bobby Matthews. Thank you again for listening, and I'll be back soon with another story.